This is Looking Forward, conversations about the future of work, brought to you by MillerKnoll.
Hey friends, welcome to the second of a two-part series on the design of the Harkin Institute facility. In the last episode, we talked with retired Senator Tom Harkin and his wife, Ruth Harkin, about the Institute itself and about their goals for creating a new headquarters for it. Today, we talk with Kevin Nordmeyer and Jason Cruz from architecture and interior design firm BNIM about the design of the facility and their process of creating it. Both Kevin and Jason have a very enlightened, human-centered love of the built environment, and you'll hear how their design approach helped to create a space where people can connect and belong, and that adapts in new ways to the changing needs of a diverse workforce. Enjoy this conversation with Kevin Nordmeyer and Jason Cruz of BNIM. Hey, Kevin and Jason, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
Great. Well, I'm super happy that you're spending some time with us, and we've got lots to dive into, but maybe we could just start with each of you telling us a little bit about yourself and the work you do at BNIM. Maybe Kevin, we could start with you.
Sure. I'm one of the principals at BNIM. I'm one of the leaders of our Des Moines office in Des Moines, Iowa, and I've been practicing for about 30 years in Iowa and the region. I started my career focusing on sustainable design, and then that continues. But then about a decade ago, I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And so given that progression of that disease, my interest has kind of by default kind of been woven into this notion of inclusive design. And with Jason and my other colleagues at BNIM, trying to expand this notion of what sustainable design should be, which would include equity and inclusion as well. And my sort of areas of expertise and sort of building types is a lot of higher education institutions and not-for-profit organizations typically is where I kind of focus.
What a cool thing that you've taken something that's affected you personally and decided to funnel it into helping others through your craft.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Great. Jason, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, thanks again for having us. My name is Jason Cruz. I'm a project architect here with BNIM Architects in Des Moines, and been here for about 12 years, and with Kevin, a lot of focus on higher education, civic building, public architecture. I guess, kind of fun fact, Ryan, the first time we met was probably the last in-person or one of the last in-person like events prior to the pandemic. I think it was what, like February 2020, we, with this project, started talking with Herman Miller and your local partnership with Pigott here. And you came out and we were, I remember talking in that room, and then it was 2 weeks later or a month later, whenever everything went down, right? It was like, how are we going to approach this project and furniture now that we're all at home? But as I was reflecting back, I was like, yeah, Ryan was probably the last new face I met prior to going digital and everyone being virtual. You're the last handshake I had.
There we go. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but yes, I got this call about the Harkin Institute from our local dealer partner, Pigott. And as you guys know, I have some family in the Des Moines area, and I was so excited to hear what was going on that I got in a plane and I met you both. And that was my last trip before quarantine as well. Yeah. I mean, I know it's a weird way to say it, but if there was a trip to end on, it was an inspired one, because watching this project unfold from a distance and seeing how you had to navigate such aspirational goals with such constraints was something that I won't forget anytime soon. Well, I want to circle back to this idea of inclusive design and even how it relates to a broader goal of sustainable design. Kevin, you gave us a little sense of how having multiple sclerosis has maybe given you a new trajectory, but give us a little bit bigger picture. Like, how do you both get interested in this field, and how do you see it affecting architecture in the future?
Well, I'll start with that, and then Jason can fill in the gaps that I'm sure I'll forget about. Our firm was one of the founders of the United States Green Building Council and the whole concept of living buildings. Our Kansas City office designed the first living building in the world and things like that. So Bob Birkebile and our Kansas City office was a national, international leader in the topic of sustainable design. And so our firm has been using a term for the last number of handful of years called human purposed integrated design. And it's our firm trying to think about what we really need to be thinking about, not only the environmental aspects of design, you know, site, water, and energy and materials and things like that, but we really need to focus on the human element, you know, the people that these buildings are allowing people to do their work or to learn and teach, things like that. So we see this topic of inclusivity and equity and wellness as equal components, or even maybe even more important components to water, energy, materials, and those kinds of things, because they all have to work together in a new definition of what sustainable design can be. And there are other people that, I mean, there's been many firms that have used human-centric design and things like that. But for us, it's really rooted in who we are, given our foundations of helping lead a sustainable design movement. Now trying to expand that to include these notions of equity is kind of where we're at.
Jason, anything to add?
Yeah, just to add, I mean, like Kevin said, with the USGBC, there are a lot of these kind of the building rating systems that a lot of people know about with LEED and Living Building. They really are starting to dabble in this area. There's pilot credits associated with accessibility and universal design. I think WELL has a really good framework for addressing some of these human purpose focused credits. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're designing spaces for people and all people. And so just like we think about the energy to and water, you know, the person aspect is really important to us and how somebody uses a space and how all people can really use a space.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly a very smart and strategic approach, but there's also a huge element of empathy here, isn't there? It's a very empathetic approach to design. I assume this means you need to understand the people for whom you're designing on a much deeper level.
Right. So the Harkin Institute project, and you've talked with Tom Harkin, but he was the author of one of the authors of the ADA. He was the leader of the ADA creation in America. And then he brought along a bipartisan coalition at the time to help create that in 1990. And he was the guy that set us off on this journey, really. Since 1990, architects, interior designers, planners have all been focused on the ADA as the baseline, as the standard that you design to. And no one's ever challenged anybody to really go beyond that much. And so Tom Harkin did. At the very first meeting in November of 2018, it was with the Harkin Institute's Disability Advisory Committee. And he sat and told us, I just want the ADA to be the baseline. He said, I challenge all of you to start to think beyond the ADA, try to be broadly inclusive of all abilities, not just the extremes, which the ADA had to address, blindness, deafness, wheelchairs. I mean, try to think of all the other things in between there. There's partial blindness, partial deaf, you know, just walking issues, not in a wheelchair, things like that. And so it set Jason and me and others in our firm off on a journey of trying to find everything we possibly could and think about it all the way through the process. And even with you, Ryan, and your team, trying to think about how the design of the furniture and the placements of the furniture and things are equally as important to how the, you know, the structure of the building is set up.
Well, we have a lot of listeners who might be in the world of architecture, interior design, but we have many others that are in real estate, human resources, other business functions. If you had to try to explain what the design process for this particular facility was like in just conversational language, you mentioned it began with a disability advocacy committee that was providing input. How did it mature after that? How did you approach it, particularly given that we were in the middle of a pandemic?
We quickly integrated the design process a little bit into a research process at the forefront, thinking that we were going to, and we'll talk about this in a little bit, I'm sure, but into a book of strategies that then we've kind of finalized and formalized into a formal edition. But at the beginning of the process, you know, we go through a programming phase where we outline in a big picture sense of like, what are the major components in the spaces within the building? You'll have X amount of meeting rooms, office space. In this building, there was an auditorium function, but already beginning to think about accessibility and going above and beyond, a lot of the things to just be more gracious and generous with space starts in that programming element. So when we think about, like, say, conference rooms, for instance, you know, how can we plug a little bit more area into the conference room so that we're not having these really long, narrow conference rooms, but we can provide a little more space around tables so that people in wheelchairs or mobility issues can navigate around a little more graciously. So that's why having an understanding of some of these principles at the forefront allow us in the programming phase to start to think about this at the forefront of a project. It's hard to do this as an afterthought because some of these principles just require just a little bit more space that once you get so far in a design process, it's hard to add. Even nowadays with current budget and escalation and inflation, it's always harder to make buildings bigger. We're always going in the opposite direction. We find ourselves.
I was just going to add, the key aspect was that engagement with the Harkin Disability Advisory Committee. As we were starting to program, as Jason mentioned, we then had this opportunity to meet with that group at their first meeting in Washington, D.C. And the first question we asked them was, what barriers still exist today, 30 years after, well, at that time, 28 years after the creation of the ADA? And they said, no one ever asked us that question. That's the problem. And the phrase back in the 70s and 80s and leading up to 1990 when the ADA was created, the disability community had a slogan that said, nothing about us without us. And it still, unfortunately, exists today, where people just make a bunch of assumptions and don't engage in a dialogue with the people that you're trying to design for. We just make assumptions, or we just design to the minimums, the ADA and so forth, make sure there's door clearances and things like that. But we would not have thought of many of the things that we incorporate into this building and that Jason then started to think about wrapping into this book idea had we not engaged with that diverse group. So for HR, you know, people in companies and other people working in businesses, business leaders and so forth, engaging a broadly inclusive group of voices on any issue is just really important to a thriving environment.
There's a member of my team, Joseph White, who loves to say, let's design with, not just for.
Right.
And that question of what barriers exist, I mean, honestly, you could ask that to anyone, couldn't you?
Right.
Absolutely. It should be standard practice.
Right.
Jason, I just want to go back for a moment to your mention that providing space a bit more generously was part of the key to doing this. I find this to be a really interesting time to set that forward as a principle, because pre-pandemic, it felt like it was densification, sell real estate costs. Now, typically the number one question I get from our customers is like, what are we going to do with some excess space? Will we see demand patterns rise as much? The notion of repurposing some of that to be more generous in an interest to be inclusive is fascinating. And I'm not sure I've heard anybody mention
that. It's a really good point. And it doesn't take a lot more, you know, right? Like in the book, you know, we talk about pathway width, and really your primary path through an office space or corridors really wants to be no less than 6 feet wide. And why we like to do that is it allows, obviously, two people in wheelchairs to pass each other with ease. People that are signing next to each other can kind of sign and not get, you know, bottlenecked where one person gets kind of overtaken by the other. Just thinking about that path through a building from the door to the desk, you know, how you weave in and out of office spaces was thought through both at the building element, but then once we were working with your team and laying out the furniture and systems throughout, just keeping those principles in mind. I mean, one of the cool things about this project and things that we learned is, you know, this idea of sliding doors wherever you can do as possible. And what's cool about the Harkin Institute is that somebody in a wheelchair mobility issue can go from any spot in the parking lot, get to the front door, not really have to navigate a ramp because there's no steps in the landscape. Everything is just flush, even transitions. They can go through the front door without opening door because we have automatic sliders. They can go to the auditorium or the boardroom because we have automatic door operators without even having to navigate around a door maneuvering position. Just that freedom of somebody to navigate freely and intuitively through a space is pretty powerful, specifically in the Harkin Institute, just as you navigate through the space and that generous space and integration with technology are allowing us to do that with buildings with more and more ease if we can think about these principles as we're designing.
Well, and having visited it recently myself, everything you're describing, while it certainly is critical for somebody that might have a mobility limitation or limited visual acuity, et cetera, but I kind of felt like every part of it was great for anyone. Like, I think most of us would prefer to walk side by side as opposed to have to force ourselves into some single file when walking down a corridor, or having doors that open for us when our hands are filled with, you know, yoga mats or whatever. I'd love it if you both would talk a little bit more about the features of the building that most excite you. And I know it's an audio only podcast, so you'll have to kind of think about how to express the nature of this to somebody who hasn't had the benefit of being in the space. But in addition to the examples you've cited, what things were in the design that you really love?
There's one that's obvious for people that see the building either online or in person, is the ramp that connects the two floors. And again, that's something that Jason and I wouldn't have thought of. There's not many times in a two-story building that you connect both floors with a ramp. And that committee in the very first meeting, when we told them that it was likely that the building was going to be two stories because of the site constraints, they said, we challenge you to connect the floors and have it be so that someone doesn't have to use an elevator or a stair to get to that second floor. So basically they were saying, connect it with a ramp. And so we started thinking about, you know, how do we do this? And so for this particular building, since it was about the Tom and Ruth Harkin Center, so woven into the notions of equity and empathy and inclusivity, the ramp not only is a connector between floors, but it's this symbol that can be seen from the outside. And we like to describe it almost as sinew. It's kind of like the sinew that weaves spaces together, connects, you know, stitches spaces to together. And so not only does it connect space for people like me in a wheelchair, but it's great for anybody to have to walk a little farther to get upstairs and get a little exercise and things like that as well. Plus it allows the gallery space that it wraps around to kind of allow people to experience a space in three dimensions. The ramp is kind of an important feature because it allows everybody to thrive and not only just people in wheelchairs.
Jason, any thoughts on your favorite features, favorite design elements?
Probably going to nerd out a little bit on the meeting room, like the main meeting room, the boardroom, because it kind of brings all of these components together as far as the building, the furniture, the technology, AV, and how all that stuff can work together and just empower everybody in the room. So the main boardroom, and this is one of the principles kind of in the all book that we go through it, it's this meeting in the round concept, right? So a traditional boardroom is this long, linear, narrow conference table, right? That usually suggests kind of a head of the table kind of concept. And then you have your one projection screen at the far end. Well, in the boardroom here, it's actually more of a square-shaped table room. So the room will serve, you know, 25-ish people, but working with the proportions of the room allowed us to then use the furniture to, in a kind of movable way, but in most settings, it's set up in the round where there's not this idea of a head or king of the table concept. But then also what that allows is the visual connection to everybody else in the room. So if somebody is signing or maybe reads lips because their hearing is not as strong, it gives them a better sight line to the other folks at the table. And then when we go to the round setting, now you also have to start thinking about technology in a little more clear way. So we have kind of confidence monitors on the side walls that allow for kind of a double projection, but we provided duplicate monitors on side walls so that now when we're in this hybrid setting, you can have kind of the person virtually talking and you can see them or signing or the interpretation on one screen and then the content on the other. So that's all starting to kind of work together in this boardroom at the Harkin Institute, and even down to the lighting scenes. You know, how can we dim the lighting, but then allow focus zones where there might still be an ASL interpreter that needs to be kind of lit up so that people can see them. So that room is just packed full of half the strategies in this book, right? But it all is kind of coming together as one. It's a pretty cool space. And it kind of opens up into that gallery two-story volume with the ramp that Kevin was alluding to earlier.
Yeah, I like that room too. And it's probably a crude reference, not a particularly accurate reference, but having those displays, instead of having one big screen at the end of a long skinny table, having them spread around the room to me evoked a little bit of like what you'd have in a sports bar where, yeah, you want to watch the game, but you're there to hang out with other people. You're not just sitting at home watching the game by yourself. It felt as though you could really concentrate on other humans while not missing the content or the remote participants. I thought it was a much better experience. I don't know too many people that love long, skinny, packed conference rooms. And so all the meeting spaces throughout the facility to me felt more open, a little bit more focused on connection with each other, but without eliminating the technology. I mean, there was remote connectivity and sizable displays in every single space.
Well, and what was really interesting too is in collaborating with you, Ryan, and others at MillerKnoll, each one of those spaces, particularly the conference settings and social spaces, there's various types of settings. So even in the small conference room or in the boardroom that Jason's talking about, there's a table that has chairs around it that are focusing on a monitor in the small conference room, but then there's also an upholstered seat bench, you know, along one wall, so that depending on someone's size, or maybe they're late to the meeting, or, you know, those kinds of things, they have choice. It's not just about a table in a room with four or five chairs or six chairs around it. And there's space to maneuver in how we organize those spaces. And I think the room that Jason's talking about too illustrates for me that when we started in the journey of writing the book, the all book and the strategies, then you and your team at MillerKnoll expanded that to include all the furniture in the guiding principles and strategies. And what was eye-opening for me is that it wasn't just about the products and the design of those products, but also the settings of mm-hmm. that furniture, which is really important. And the boardroom that Jason's talking about, it's not, you know, we have these flexible tables that are organized in that roundish shape that Jason mentioned. Each one of those has features that are adjustable and electrified and all that kind of stuff. But then the arrangement of those pieces of furniture is something that it's obvious to you, Ryan. It's obvious to many interior designers, but it was a great learning experience for us as we thought about inclusivity and this broadly inclusive spectrum of people.
Yeah. I mean, for the sake of our listeners, we tend to use the term setting to describe like a small little micro environment. It could be a room, it could be an area. And it is a little bit like Legos where, yeah, I hope we make the best bricks in the industry, but what you do with them, how you right. creatively apply them is where a lot of the magic is. When I was in and by the way, we will talk about the book momentarily because I know we've mentioned it a few times and I want to make sure we get to it. But when I was in the facility, there were things that really spoke to me. The amount of choice and variety you offered in a space that's generous but not huge was really pronounced for me. I noticed subtle details like the fabric having a high degree of contrast on the seat pan to the carpeting to make sure that somebody maybe who has an astigmatism or just anybody can find the edge of that chair. There was a great deal of visual accessibility throughout the space. You could see each other, but it didn't feel too open. Didn't feel like it was one of those open offices where, you know, you can't get anything done. And I don't know if there was an emphasis on biophilic design. And for the sake of our listeners, that's just a fancy word to say bringing the outdoors in. But there was a lot of natural light, greenery. It felt very healthy. Was that part of the goal?
Yeah, it all has to sing, right? So like all those things coming together just make it so successful. And that's what's a little special about this one is that, like you said, it's not a huge building with a modest budget. So we had to be really careful where we spent that money or emphasize those things. So like that clear story light that's in the office space that kind of lets light kind of shine over that open office setting. So although those open offices are, I mean, the open desking workstations are kind of centered in the building and maybe aren't adjacent to an exterior wall, because you have that clear story light, because the offices that are adjacent have glass fronts to let views through the space, you're still able to make that connection to the outside and to your surroundings and be aware, really helps that kind of office setting. But yeah, it kind of goes back to some of that original stuff Kevin started with, where it all just gets woven within this greater idea of sustainability. So emphasizing, you know, daylight views out, the biophilic design, all getting wrapped into then also making it accessible to everyone is just even more powerful.
As an urban building with a fairly busy street immediately to the north, we were able to, since Drake University, where the Harkin Institute is housed, owned basically the whole block, we were able to allow for an east landscaped area, plaza entrance area, and a west sort of landscaped area as well. Both of those function as stormwater management devices. So they're bioswales that use natural, you know, plants and so forth to process stormwater. And very recently, Tom and Ruth Harkin expanded the plant species mix in those, where right now they are absolutely gorgeous. They have all of these different flowering plants in both of these areas. So when you're on the first or second floor, you can look out of windows on the east and west and see these, you know, great landscaped, you know, rich, colorful spaces. So it's not just about the daylight coming in, but it's about, like Jason said, those views out to these great spaces as well that we were able to create.
Yeah, right. And it is a busy road right in front of it.
Right.
It all has to sing. I'm quoting you on that one, Jason, moving forward. I do want to talk about what we've referenced several times, which is the book. And I'm already mentally taking note that we might need to start printing more copies of the book. I literally keep a copy of this on my desk and find myself looking through it almost daily. Can you talk a little bit about your desire to create a book that shared some of these principles and practices and what your goals for it were?
I'll start, Kevin, and you fill in. But, you know, obviously, Senator Harkin put some pretty ambitious goals on this project, right? And at the very get-go, you know, our meeting with the disability committee, you come out of those meetings with just like your head filled with all this new information that you're learning. And we scoured the various resources we have for more information. And very early on, not too much past like the programming phase, we're like, well, Kevin and I and a few others in our office were, you know, hand in hand working on the project. But we were like, we have 70 other people in our firm and count all the other designers, you know, out there. How can we make something that is a resource that comes out of this research we're doing specifically for this project to get incorporated in the other projects that we do in the office, but then also share it with everyone so that all buildings can benefit from kind of the synthesis of information we've gathered. So we were collecting information and we roped you guys in when you were brought in on the system side and integrated you into that process. And you guys brought in more research. We talked with a lot of folks that are experts on your side and the systems and furniture and kept collecting. And then finally, once the building was close to being complete, we started putting together what we were calling these kind of building strategies. And from a building standpoint, there's about 19. And then when you get into the kind of some of the furniture strategies, it grows into about another 18 or 19. So almost like 40 building strategies that we said, these are things that are above and beyond the ADA that are ideas that we find important that are integrated into this project that for no reason couldn't be incorporated into every project that we do. And so we've tried to make it as easy to navigate and quickly understand the strategies and things that we implemented into the Harkin Institute so that other designers can kind of use this guidebook when they're starting projects or need to reference something to kind of quickly grasp at the beginning of a project, what are those important concepts so that they can start to think about them early on. As we noted earlier, you know, sooner you can start to integrate some of these things about path width, maneuverability, access to certain technologies. It just helps the design and outcomes for everybody.
And we specifically chose to organize this in such a way that would be a series of guiding principles and not real prescriptive kinds of things. It assumed that everybody knew what the ADA was. Everybody knew how to do door clearances and the right size of toilet stalls and all that kind of stuff. I mean, because that is the baseline and it's the standard and law requires that. What we chose to do was to create guiding principles that would help create a spirit of place for inclusivity, so that things aren't so in your face obvious that there are special exceptions made for people with disabilities. It's just part of weaving these ideas within the creation of space. And the things that we utilized were, as Jason mentioned, was the four guiding principles are generous space, equitable experiences, creating a clear path, and individual empowerment. So those things are so broad that they can apply to anything, as Jason mentioned, and then there are specific strategies under each one of those. And then you also applied those same ideas to the furniture, you know, products and settings. And we see this as a moment in time. We see this as a description of what we were able to learn and what we were able to apply to the Harkin Institute building. But we're looking to continue to elevate and collaborate with you and the Harkin Institute and others to try to expand this book over time and these strategies over time. I'm sure there are more things out there that we could learn and apply and create more strategies than what we have in this. But it was very deliberate that it's not like LEED, it's not like Living Building Standard, where it's like 0.3.2.1.6, you know, is these kind of requirements. We wanted it to be much more intuitive and easy for people to just understand concepts and not necessarily very specific, detailed kinds of standards. So this is, it's creating a spirit of place, ultimately.
And before I forget, gents, I'm sure many of our listeners would love to be able to peruse this book. I've got a physical hard copy, but if someone doesn't, how can they access it? Kevin, do you have a suggestion on where they can find it?
Right. We have a virtual copy, digital copy online that's accessible for anybody. It doesn't cost anything. If you go to bnim.com, click on the library button, you'll find the all book in our library. You can see a virtual copy of it. I think you might even be able to even download a copy of it from there as well.
Awesome. Well, when I think a little bit about the move towards accessibility historically, while I think there's been a lot of folks within the real estate, facilities, interior design, architecture world that knows that it's the right thing, it maybe has implied retrofitting of bathrooms with big, you know, handles or a widening of doors. Like, it feels additive to something that already exists, not always as attractive, maybe as people might like, and in some cases, expensive. This feels like it shifted the perspective that from the outset, there's an approach to design that doesn't necessarily feel like any of those things, that creates something that's truly beautiful and a much better experience for everyone. And I personally subscribe to the belief that in this era of work, we can't just expect people to always want to work from an office. And so flipping the purpose of the office from being about status and supervising work, which is where its roots were 100 years ago, towards fostering something that feels much more like a place where you belong and that you're going to really enjoy provides a pretty clear ROI. That's how I might frame it. But I'm just curious, as you talk with others in the industry and beyond, what kind of advice, what kind of encouragement might you give others who maybe haven't already designed a project like this, but would really like to move beyond traditional approaches to accommodation?
Well, again, it starts with engaging the disability community in that process from day one. You shouldn't assume you know everything, and the ADA is not going to cover everything. So it's engaging all of those voices in any kind of project. It might be a streetscape project. It might be a renovation of a building on a corporate campus or a college campus. It might be a small renovation. It might be a large new building. But engaging those voices and asking those questions about what barriers do you still face today is one we should keep asking, because people experience barriers in different ways all the time. And we'll continue to learn how to expand these concepts. And then, you know, look at this book that we've created. And there are other people with other universal design books over the last decade or more that have been out there. You know, just try to start absorbing everything that's out there and learn about how to create universally accessible buildings is key.
Awesome. Jason, anything to add?
Yeah. I mean, we were fortunate enough to have the Harkin Disability Committee that had some great folks from all over the country that come together as kind of this think tank, right? But I would say a lot of college, university campuses, and even now corporations have these little subset, you know, accessibility groups on campus or within that you could tap into at any time in a design process. I think just thinking to other settings we've worked in, there have definitely been those groups within an entity, whether it be a corporation or a higher ed client. And they should be a stakeholder that's brought in right after you go meet with the deans or, you know, the vice presidents of a company, because they're going to be working in those spaces just as much as those others. Back to your point, Ryan, about thinking about this for everybody being a place belonging. And I think I'd just add to that, when you were talking, Ryan, I was thinking about what Kevin has said in the past about like kind of long life, loose fit, right? Like we designed this building 2018. It was finishing construction as we were middle of a pandemic in 2021, right? And so they were able, because of the design aspects of the building, and they were able to pivot this building, and they didn't use it as we programmed it, as we designed it, for probably the first 2 years of its existence. One great story that came out of the pandemic and all the troubles that we had with it was that they used the building as a vaccination clinic for the first 6 months after construction. And it was set up, you know, obviously we didn't design this thing to be a medical clinic by any means when we were working with you or with the stakeholders, but they were able to pivot because we provided those wider corridors so people could be spread out, keep that 6 feet social distancing that got ingrained in everyone's mind, right? And so Drake and University and the Hark Institute were able to kind of pivot this new building into something that fit the needs of this time, which just seemed like a great success story.
Yeah, what a great move towards adaptive reuse over time. And by the way, I think the notion of including employee resource groups, yes, those that are focused on disabilities and beyond, is such a practical way of making sure that the design process is more inclusive. I think it's a wonderful suggestion. Well, guys, we're running long on time. I'm super thankful for you, your partnership, your impact on the world. Thanks for joining our podcast.
Thank you very much, Ryan, for asking us.